Okay, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Let's get rid of Google Assistant and do that again. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. It makes me laugh every single time. Honestly, all you've got to do is say good morning, and I've got Google Assistant insisting that it wants to help me with helping me have a good morning. So I'm going to start again anyway. All right, Sean. Welcome to the show, mate. If you want to ring in, you feel free to have a chat if you want to for a few minutes. I'm really just doing a voice warm up because I've got a radio show to do this afternoon on an actual radio station, and I need to get my voice warmed up a little bit and get my head sorted out. So I was just going to do a bit of a rehearsal. But you're welcome to hang around or call in or do whatever. Yeah, it's taken me a while to work this stuff out, but it seems like the shows work better if I do a warm up. So I tend to do 20 minutes or half an hour on here on a Saturday, just to get my voice moving and get my thoughts flowing a bit better than they usually do without it. I struggle, I stutter a little bit, and I struggle to get my words out if I haven't warmed my voice up properly. I struggle to get my thoughts out without that, so it seems like that's the way I've got to do it, and it just means that I've got a fighting chance of having a show without me stuttering and losing my train of thought this afternoon. But anyway, it's taken me 18 months to work that out, because I tried it and it seemed to work, so I tried it again and it seemed to work again, so it's all experimental, but that's the way it seems to work for me, at least. And the show's going to be this afternoon's going to be Andy Warhol and the Velvet Underground and Nico. So I need to find some documentary footage that I can use, which is partly why I set the show up. So I'm just going to do that, mate. If you don't want to call in and have a chat, I'll just do that. So stay tuned. I'll be with you in about 30 seconds. There you go, that's Bowie, David Bowie from the album Hunky Dory, and a tune called Andy Warhol. And now I've got to find a documentary, so let's do that.
Op art, underground movies, call it what you will. These two are the leaders. No party in New York is considered a success unless they are there. It's hard to explain this young lady and man. They say they don't want to be explained. One is a beautiful actress, and she calls herself a superstar. The other is a young man named Andy Warhol, the creator of pop art. So here are the two leading exponents of the new scene, Edie Sedgwick and Andy Warhol. Tonight, I
would
have taken this tie off here.
I can hardly breathe.
What's the matter?
It's so nerve-wracking.
Is it
nerve-wracking? These people. I'm not used to having to face all these people.
Well, they're friendly. They're very friendly.
Well, this and a rather tight jacket makes it a little more friendly. It's hard to breathe.
Wants to all blow at you? Good evening, Andy.
I must warn you, Andy won't say a word.
Why?
He's not used to making really public appearances, so I think he'll whisper answers to me if you ask him a question.
Can I listen while he whispers?
I'll whisper to you.
Aren't you going to say one word, Andy?
I know.
We're very curious, and that's why everybody is so friendly. We read much about underground movies and all of Andy's work, which we know so well. What would you first of all tell the audience, for those who might not know what underground movies are? These are not war stories.
Oh, how can I tell you? It's so far they've been visual experiments. People making movies trying to see if they could do it.
And they are not shown in theaters.
They're shown in one theater. In somewhere down in the village. It's just one theater. Otherwise, private showings.
I see.
Don't really know.
What would be the subject matter, for example? They're not stories, necessarily.
Some of them are.
What have been?
There's been one that's been a take. I don't dare say it. I really don't. Because everything
you
I say gets
me. And I'll
whisper to Andy.
Then how will we know?
I don't want to be involved in that. That was all
Edie, talk about sleep.
Andy had a fabulous movie going with somebody sleeping for 8 hours, was it? 8 hours? 8 hours. It's true. I have to say it's true. It's an 8-hour movie, and the camera's on somebody. And all they're doing is sleeping. Well, you can see them breathing, you know.
And does it take 8 hours to watch it?
Well, that's what was all before I got in on it. Now it's all changed.
Oh, there are.
It really is.
There's dialogue now?
We have other influences, and we're going to have a big production, a real film.
Which film are you
going to
do?
Which isn't going to be 8 hours. It'll be an hour and a half.
Oh.
And it will have more than one person in.
What's that going to be called?
Jane Eyre.
Well, really? That's been done.
When? That must have been 1,000 years ago.
You mean the original story of...
Yes, can you believe it? Out of the underground movies, Jane Eyre is going to emerge. Literally.
And you're going to star in it.
Yes.
How will it be different?
Can you imagine Jane Eyre being somewhat spacey and timeless? And using the plot, but putting it into a modern context. Modern context. Literally.
Really?
You don't sound convinced.
No, I am. I think it'd be an interesting experiment.
I can. I think it'll be terrific. You want to start it?
No.
You
should. No. Well, are you playing Jane?
Yeah, I'll play Jane.
Oh, well, I could play Air.
Too far there, Renee. You made Andy laugh. Are you all right, Andy?
Yeah, I heard him. He said yes. You broke the spell now.
Sorry.
Edie, tell me this.
That's a drag.
What?
I don't want to hear any more of that.
Oh, yeah, stop that, will you please? Now, you are a superstar, or you want to be a superstar. What is the difference between a star and a superstar?
It's two things. One is a joke, and the other is possibly a real superstar, if there could be such a thing.
Has there ever been? Let me light that for
you. There must have been a while. It's a question of shaking.
No, that's all right. I'll help you out. You haven't been on television before, have you?
Twice.
Oh.
And it's terrifying. It's very easy here compared to the other ones.
I know. Don't look at anybody. We'll just talk here. Tell me, who would you consider in the past to have been a superstar?
Oh, those kind of questions are too difficult because they're fabulous stars, but I wouldn't want to say superstar is a modern word. I don't want to apply it to the past.
Well, what is your definition of a superstar?
Something either fantastic or ridiculous, and that remains to be seen. It may be ridiculous. If we can't get it off the ground, it'll be ridiculous. If we can do a whole movie, it'll be a superstar.
Andy, how did you discover Edie?
It could be.
Come on, you can tell me.
By mistake.
By mistake?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Andy's going to tell me. Aren't you?
No, Andy's going to Andy, I'm the one who has to make a fool of myself, and Andy can just sit there quietly.
How did you two meet?
I came to Andy's studio with a friend, and I didn't know Andy, and I really didn't know too much about New York. And he was in the process of making an underground movie, which when I walked in, I couldn't really tell what was happening. There were lots of lights and people running around doing things. And then there were some people huddled together with more lights on them, and they were sort of making sounds. And all of a sudden, I understood they were reading a script. And that was the part of the movie.
And now you star.
It was in progress. Well, I just happened to be pushed onto a chair in the middle of it to sit there. And I really didn't have anything to do with it. Because I never would do it otherwise. And I just sat there. And from that time on, I got up the courage to do some more. I'm not sure I ever will again.
Yes, you will. I can tell by looking, my dear. We'll be right back after station break.
All right. That was the Merv Griffin show. It's Andy Warhol not saying anything on the Merv Griffin show.
This week, Andy Warhol. These are some of the most famous, valuable, and controversial works of art ever made. For many, they epitomize all that they detest about modern art. This one is a lurid, distorted picture of a film star. There are more than 20 versions. Just one of them sold recently for $28 million. And the artist didn't even paint it by himself. That artist, Andy Warhol, is as famous and controversial as the images he created. Warhol predicted that in the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes, and then spent his life making it come true, exploiting the media to transform himself and his eccentric, beautiful entourage into celebrities. Some even say that he heralded the consumer-led, celebrity-driven world we live in today. His influence really does seem to be everywhere, from reality TV to Facebook to magazines, even to the way that music's performed. And his images are incredibly familiar. After all, Andy Warhol's the man who painted Campbell's Tomato Soup and also canonized the movie star Marilyn Monroe. But just because his work is so widely reproduced and he's so incredibly famous, does that mean that he's actually any good? I'm going to try and find the answer. My first stop is the O2 Arena in London. Good or bad, Warhol's art is worth a fortune today. This box arrived at the O2 carrying one of his works about to go on show before being auctioned. It's a portrait of Michael Jackson, made by Warhol in 1984. It bears all the hallmarks of a classic Warhol. It's a print with brushstrokes of paint layered on top, based not on Jackson himself, but on a photo of him. Warhol simplifies everything. Detail is replaced by strong, garish colours. It's almost cartoon-like. It both reduces Jackson's face to a mask, but also fixes it forever in a burst of colour. work can still pull in the crowds. So what is it about Andy Warhol and his art that continues to fascinate so many? I've come to Pittsburgh, in the heart of industrial America. Andy Warhol was born here in 1928, and the city is certainly proud of its son. His work and his image are everywhere. There's even a bridge that's named after him. While I'm visiting, Pittsburgh's having a moment of glory, hosting the world's leaders for the G20 summit. And the spouses of the presidents and prime ministers are being given a tour of the Andy Warhol Museum. This is the bus that's going to the Andy Warhol Museum, so I better get on it. So this is the Andy Warhol Bridge, and the museum is somewhere just on the other side by the river. I think we'll be able to see it in a second. The museum's huge. 7 floors dedicated to Warhol's work. Here we go. This is Gordon Brown's wife just getting out of the car. This is the wife of the French president, Carla Bruni, one of the most stylish women in the world. Andy would have loved to have made her portrait. Hi, Carla. Do you like Andy Warhol?
Sorry?
Are you a fan of Andy Warhol?
Yes, definitely.
What do you like about his art?
I like everything. I like very much the Velvet Underground, and I like to see him in pictures.
You think that Andy would have liked to have made your portrait?
I don't know.
Because he made one of Jackie Kennedy, and now you're one of the most stylish women in the world.
I don't know, but and every time he would shoot or make the portrait of anyone, it would just be brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Thank you so much.
That was her. I think he would have liked to have made her portrait. I thought she looked very... I feel a bit like Andy, a bit intoxicated with the magic of the stardust that's sprinkled over the other side of the barricade. Today, Andy Warhol's associated with glamour, celebrity, and decadence. But his childhood was very different. His parents were poor Slovakian immigrants, and Andrew Warhola grew up in a slum ghetto during the Great Depression of the 30s, when Pittsburgh was a dirty, industrial, steel-making city. This museum recreates life in the tenements where immigrant families like Andy's lived. Food was often scarce, and Andy's mum would sometimes make soup out of water and ketchup. The tin of Campbell's tomato soup was a real treat. Andy later said that his childhood home was the most terrible place he'd ever been. When he was 8, he was struck down with a neurological disorder, which kept him off school for nearly a year. It left him with the poor skin and thin hair that always embarrassed him, and a shyness he never overcame. He became an anxious social outcast and rarely left the apartment. His mother, Julia, lavished attention on him, providing movie magazines, colouring in books, comics, as well as cut-out paper dolls, and all of them influenced his work in later life. It's almost as if the kitchen became his first artist studio with his mum as his assistant. She would reward him with a chocolate bar when he finished a good drawing and encourage him to make collages and colour in and read to him in her thick Czechoslovakian accent. Along with his glamorous movie magazines, Andy's only other escape from his drab and dreary life in the tenement were his regular visits to church. Religion played a big part in Andy's life growing up. He spent weekends with his mother worshipping at church, gazing at the golden screens with their Byzantine icons. During those Grey Depression years, these formed the rich imagery of his childhood. It seems to me that Andy's two childhood passions, Catholic religion and the movie stars in his magazines, later fused together in his art, where celebrities became the icons and the objects of worship. All the lonely months Andy spent in the tenement with his colouring books and his collages paid off. He won a place at a local art college, and just a week after graduation, he escaped from the Pittsburgh ghetto. Andy moved to New York in 1949, age 21, with only a small suitcase and some samples of his work. He dreamt of becoming a famous artist, but in the meantime, just hoped to make a living as a commercial illustrator. He'd arrived in one of the most exciting cities on Earth, at the threshold of the fabulous 50s. The boutiques of Fifth Avenue blazoned a new style of luxury. Andy was desperate to join this glamorous world. It was tantalizingly close, but still out of reach. With only $200 in his pocket, Andy arrived here in the Lower East Side and moved into a dingy tenement building that had no hot water and was crawling with cockroaches. But he was edging ever closer to his dream.
The New York he dreamt of was just uptown, and soon enough, Andy made his way to meet the sophisticated art directors of the city's fashion magazines, carrying a portfolio of his drawings in a tatty brown paper bag.
Andy's persistence began to pay off when Glamour magazine asked him to illustrate a feature aptly called Success is a Job in New York. They liked his whimsical drawings with their quirky, charming figures. But further success didn't come immediately for Andy, who spent much of his time hanging out in a pretty coffee shop called Serendipity.
I'm just an old-fashioned girl with an old-fashioned mind.
This was a popular haunt of all his favourite movie stars. Marilyn Monroe even had her own table here, and it's still going. Recently, Madonna threw a birthday party for her daughter here.
I'd like a plain, simple car, a cerise.
Lovely. Thank you very much. When he was broke, Andy would knock off drawings like these and swap them for pastries and ice cream.
I like the old-fashioned flowers, violets are for me.
Serendipity was an oasis for Andy, where he could sit and gaze across the tables at Marlena Dietrich and Marilyn and indulge his fantasies of life amongst the stars. The owner of the cafe, Stephen Bruce, was one of the first people to recognise the potential in Andy's drawings.
Hi, I'm Stephen Bruce, and welcome to Serendipity.
Thank you. Well, you're the owner of Serendipity.
Yes, I am, and I see you have our favourite drink, which was Andy Warhol's favourite drink.
He liked this
also.
One, didn't he?
Yeah. Frozen hot chocolate and lemon icebox pie.
Is that what it is? My God.
Yes. Madison Avenue was just a few doors away, and he was trying to sell all of his artwork to Madison Avenue advertising people. Yes, and he started coming in and having a cappuccino and showing me his rejects. He was very sad because they didn't buy anything. And I said, well, there's some wonderful shoes here. Let's frame them. So we did. We put them on the walls of Serendipity.
Was this his first exhibition?
First exhibition, yes. And we sold them for $25. We did split. He got $12.50 and I got $12.50.
Back in the 50s, when Andy was coming here, what was he like? In those days, he dressed in quite a kind of... He was called Raggedy Andy, I think.
Yes, he was very preppy. He just came from school, and he had his own hair then, and he had very weak eyes. So he had very dark glasses on, and sometimes he would put cardboard punctured with hat pins so he could see out of it, so the light would just filter through.
He was too sensitive to light.
Very sensitive to light.
Maybe that explains why he always wore sunglasses throughout his
Exactly,
life.
Exactly. And I think also that's why he liked, you know, a wonderful color.
Andy's eye for color landed him work with a company supplying leather to designers, run by Teddy and Arthur Edelman. Hi, I'm Alistair.
Oh, my goodness.
Hi, how are you?
You must be Teddy.
I'm so happy
Hello.
To see you. Yeah,
welcome.
Thank you very much indeed.
I'm happy we have a chance to show you our
this is your showroom.
Wonderful
this
is world of leather.
Yeah. They'd use him during the 50s, not just as an illustrator, but also as a consultant coming up with marketing ideas. How easy was he to work with? If you said to him, here's my idea, I need something quickly, was he accommodating?
100%.
Quick, and sensational, always on the button.
And on time and no ego. Amazing.
No ego at all.
No, he would come in with this terrible looking portfolio, his black portfolio, it was all a mess. Then he would open it up and he would have maybe 5 suggestions. Usually we loved at least 1 or 2, but if we didn't, it was no problem. He'd say, that's okay. That was a big sentence. And he would bring it back, come back the next day with obviously the perfect answer because he was so smart. He was so intelligent.
He designed everything from a silver-clad exhibition stand where he draped the company's leather product over motorbikes to the logo that they still use to this day. How would you describe his talent as a commercial artist? What was his secret?
He always had magic, and he always had an inner kind of charm. It was never fake. When you looked at it, you got like this inside smile, which made you feel wonderful. And I think that was part of his magic. He didn't talk this way, but yeah. This is the way he drew.
Andy's quiet demeanor masked an insatiable ambition, which along with his talent as a commercial illustrator, soon got him noticed. His delicate, playful drawings had the modern look that Manhattan's art directors wanted, and the commissions soon started rolling in. Andy's signature style was the blotted line, a technique he'd developed at college. I'm going to have a go at it myself. You're going to see a beautiful shoe appear in front of your very eyes. Look at this. There's the high heel. There is the shoe. We'll put a little kind of Warhol butterfly on with a few dots. And that's all on the shiny paper. Now we cross our fingers, make sure the ink is transferred. And then this is the big reveal. Well, it's not bad. I'm not sure what it looks like. That could be a Warhol butterfly, I suppose. But I suppose the key point is that you see here is the blotted line. The ink on the shiny paper is transferred to the absorbent paper, and you get this very beautiful, blurry, jagged effect of the line, which has a printed feel, even though it's something incredibly simple. It's funny how popular that retro 50s feel still is today. I mean, you see it everywhere, on cards, on wrapping paper, or even on kids' books like this one, which is Madonna's The English Roses. What's incredible when you flick through and look at these illustrations is how similar they are to Andy's commercial work. You see exactly the same sort of uneven, broken, that handmade quality. The line feels very playful and witty, and you've got the same candy floss colours. I never really realised the debt that books like these owe to Warhol when he was excelling as a commercial designer back in the 50s. Well, just compare this drawing by Warhol of a cake. Look how similar they feel, with the same colours, the same quality to that line, which feels very handmade, hand-printed.
Okay, that's fine, something else, because this is a bit long and drawn out. It's a bit long-winded for me. I need to find something a bit snappier. I found a couple the other day that were really good, and now I don't know where they are. Here we go. No, it's an interview. 45 seconds of an interview is no good to me.
Marie-Laure avec l'exposition dans une galerie française, dans les Warhol.
Oui, une exposition faite exclusivement pour cette galerie française, la galerie Lavigne Bastille. Et vous allez pouvoir ainsi redécouvrir Andy Warhol grâce à Nicole Brice.
56 ans.
En 1962, Andy Warhol a 32 ans et a déjà fait des études de graphisme dans l'édition et s'est intéressé au théâtre. Mais il s'affirmera plus avec ses portraits-images, objets de série, qui illustrent pour lui la réalité de la société américaine, société de consommation. Avec un goût de la provocation évident, il se lance dans la création cinématographique underground à New York, entouré de Morrissey et Alessandro. Puis la danse, la musique, le rock, le journalisme, la TV l'attirent. Il touche à toutes les formes de création et devient le phare tous azimuts de New York. Il se veut un artiste commercial et superficiel, c'est faux. Warhol est aussi sensible, intelligent que cultivé. Le voici à Paris, où il présente une exposition chez Lavigne Bastille, une très jeune galerie, 10 tableaux qui consacrent la statue de la liberté de New York.
Celebration in New York, so I guess it's on everybody's mind.
Il est dit aussi aussi un journal interview dans lequel il tâte du journalisme, une expression qui lui coûte une fortune. Alors il se lance corps et âme dans la TV qu'il adore.
And a TV show too. I'm trying to do the same thing you're doing, interviewing people, but I'm not very good at it.
No.
No.
Why? TV more than cinema.
Well, the TV is much more exciting. You know, with all the cable television in New York, there's like, you turn on your TV and there's like 50 stations. And you can just turn from station to station. You never get tired. There's so much to see.
And music? Rocks?
And music, yeah, they have music on all 24 hours of music. And
is life in New York as interesting now than 20 years ago?
Actually, it's more interesting.
More and more?
Well, even Paris is more interesting.
Now.
Alors, vous pensez, Andy Warhol, que la France est en train de retrouver sa place dans le monde artistique?
Well, I never thought it went away.
Oh, yes.
Si vous voulez traquer Warhol, allez dans tous les endroits où il faut être.
Voilà pour l'essentiel de l'actualité.
Alright, I did think there was going to be slightly more Andy Warhol in there than it turned out, so I might just use it anyway because it sounded pretty good in French to me. I don't know what they were saying, but it sounded pretty good, and I'll make a bit of a kind of an interlude if I can find 20 minutes in English and then just put some French in there, and then another five minutes from somewhere else. That's be 25-30 minutes sorted out for the main piece, and then I'll top and tail it with me Nico story and me Velvet Underground story. And that should be enough for an hour. So I'll put that on my playlist and see if I found a two-part documentary the other day and I can't find it now. But I was going to use part of that. Here we go. This one. I think it was this one. The first half of part two seemed to be pretty good. If it's too visual, though, I won't be able to use it on the radio. It has to have some kind of commentary going on.
Maybe this is really bourgeois of me, but we want fuller lives, and we want to know the meanings of the things that drive our lives. We want to redeem the garbage in our life. That seems to me, that's why I look at art. And the thing I feel when I look at Warhol is maximum redemption of lost material.
This is the one.
He puts being back where there was deadness, I think. It's not that he reproduces a banalized, commodified experience, but that he puts something back into it. Color, sequence, gravity, iconic stature, gold. He puts all sorts of things back into it. He puts repetition and the pleasure of repetition, the pleasure of making one thing and then another and not discarding either one of them. He puts that back into human experience. And art took that out a long time ago when it separated the artists from the non-artists. And there were some who got to make pretty things and others who could at best be pretty things or buy pretty things. And Andy said, oh no, you can actually make them. You can be a non-artist who is the world's greatest artist. And that's why he's controversial. He is a non-artist. He's not an artist in a funny way. And he's the greatest artist. And that's why he matters, I think. That he's the sort of Oprah language, he's empowering. You know, do it yourself. That's one of his paintings. I think it's a huge motto of his, to seize the means of production. But isn't that what the proletariat's supposed to do? Isn't that what Andy did when he made films? Everything he did seemed to be about seizing the means of reproduction. And it's a power move.
The generosity of Andy's work. And I look at it and I think that it's about playing God. It's about creating life. It's about that spark of trying to just, in the most economical means, to just get a little bit ahead of life itself. I think Andy was really about finding grace and about sharing acceptance. You know, the art in Andy's work is about sharing where we are. It's like, you know, giving us our parameters and giving us more. It's that increase of really the possibilities. And for that moment, you know, he's a great alchemist. At that moment, we are greater than we've ever been.
So there's Pop popping in out of cubism and collage, but it's because it's a master artist who sees this and understands it. It's the design that went into that in the manufacturing process is so exquisite, and it's just a pack of cigarettes. But if you really look at it, it's a master crafted art piece. In the 60s, the whole world became exposed like that. And that was the gist of what Pop was in America here, that everything became art. Walking down the street, all of a sudden the fire hydrant is so beautiful. And you see it's connecting this with your life. And then when all the LSD stuff started coming around, everybody got into the hallucinogen thing, you could see that the fire hydrant was alive. And it never goes away when you get it.
But not inexhaustible. Sooner or later, there's going to be a problem. You're going to fall into the classic trap of self-imitation. I'll do it like I did last time. And I think that he knew that. He understood that he had exhausted the vein that he discovered in pop art. That's why the film was so important for him, because it gave him a new place to take his visual and graphic genius. Stravinsky has been asked once, what do you do when you run out of ideas? What do you do when you don't know what you're going to do next? And he answered, I wait as an insect waits. And then you jump. Andy waited and waited, and then something would happen, then he jumped. Enough was happening all the time, so that he had endless productivity. He was a demon worker, absolutely demon worker. One of the reasons he became an amphetamine addict was so he could stay up all night working. Not all night partying, working.
He was making movies nonstop, especially The Silver Factory. It was almost a 24-hour place. If Andy would go home, Levine and those people would still be there shooting up speed, making movies. You know, it was a very open, free-floating kind of creativity going on.
I mean, it was lunatic in a way. He controlled a whole bunch of people, and the factory was an extraordinary place. There must have been 15 or 20 people there. A lot of them on their way down destroyed people. And it was sort of a halfway house. And perhaps what drove Andy was really to be in that position of voyeur and to use these people for his art.
I call myself Candy Wormhole now.
It's called Blonde on a Bum Trip. What's it about?
It's about a naive young lady who goes to Hollywood to make it big.
Andy was attracted to self-destructive people. Andy was attracted to addicts in a way. Andy liked people who were extremely one thing or another. He always said that he liked beauties and talkers. He liked people who looked good, or he liked people who could talk a lot and have these very sort of extreme personalities. They were the raw material of his films, of his art in that sense. But I think those people, you know, burn out. Drag queens, I don't think, have the world's greatest life expectancy rate. There were a lot.
have destructive people around. And they were destructive of others and destructive of themselves. It was going on constantly. And Warhol has been many times reproached with some justice for having let it happen. But and he needed them, among other things, artistically. He needed them because he needed ideas. He was the receiver of ideas. He was not the generator of ideas. He was the receiver of ideas. Something would come by him, and it would work for him, and he would do it. What he was trying to do was bring in the whole world until something hit and happened. He was receptive in a way that meant a kind of absolute openness to him. Sooner or later, it was going to have to get really hairy, and it did.
I'm a phony, well, so are you.
I think the narrative was, if you let in everyone, you let in madness, too. And it had changed.
Wow, the creep. I'll do violence, all right.
I suppose there's also the Jesus narrative that becomes more evident retrospectively. You know, looking backward from the Last Supper paintings through his assassination or near assassination, sense of Andy as martyr, scarified body, gunshot wounds. Also the sense that part of the Jesus narrative or the martyr narrative is a sense of Andy being a representative man who has to take on the sufferings of mankind or whose plight is symbolic and universal and it's somehow altruistic for him to endure his tribulations because he's doing it for other people. But there's often a sense that Andy picked on others or abused others. I think the story is really more that Andy felt himself to be the martyr or the victim.
On the surface, Andy was so cool, so heartless, but I somehow sense that underneath it was always this kind of pain, this ultra-sensitivity, this hypersensitivity, you know, because he was so sensitive. He saw it all. He knew. I mean, he felt he could read between the lines of what everybody was saying. I think it's like everything kind of came together in Andy, you know, and it was a burden for him.
Okay, that's probably enough documentary footage for me. It was only 10 minutes, but that's probably enough. I don't know, I might find there's some material on the Velvet Underground I can use as well. So I don't know whether to do half an hour just on Warhol or to try and fit everybody in. It's only an hour show, so I think probably just Warhol, focus on one person, and then I can do the Velvet Underground another time and focus on Lou Reed or Nico or whatever, I don't know. But thanks for coming in, guys. I'll keep the room open. If you want to have a conversation, feel free to call in. There we go. Right, well, so.
Hey, how you going, Dennis? Am I coming through all right, mate?
Yeah, I can hear you fine, man. I can hear you fine.
Ah, that's good. So, why was that in French before? Was that obviously the part of the country? Does he have French roots or something himself?
No, it was just a French TV doing an interview. But obviously they do like a little portrait of him or whatever. They explain who he is and all that malarkey in French before they interview him. So I was expecting there to be more Andy Warhol in there, to be honest. He only said about three lines in the entire thing.
Yeah, I know. They can catch you out sometimes, some of those sort of things, eh? Yeah.
But it sounded good. Whoops, let me turn that down a bit. So I might use it anywhere, just because it's a nice break. If I use 10 minutes of a documentary before and then the French thing and then 10 minutes after, it breaks it up a little bit.
Yeah, it does. It's good. Yeah. Well, I was just going to head out anyway. I'm just going to eat. So I just wanted to drop in and say, yeah, good stuff from what I heard anyway. I'm looking forward to just going back and hearing it from the start.
Yeah, man. I'll post the show I do this afternoon. I'll post. I may not post this one. I'll post it on Telegram, but I may not post it on Podbean.
Okay, then. Yeah, whatever works out.
Yeah. But yeah, because this is just a rehearsal. In effect, it's just me sorting my material out and sorting my head out.
Okay. All right, good stuff. All right, mate, I'm going to have to leave. So, yeah, just want to say good day. And, yeah. All right, I'll catch you around the traps, no doubt.
No worries. Have a good evening.
Cheers, Dan. Okay, see you, mate.
See ya. I'm quite happy to keep the room open and just plow on with more documentary footage. I think we'll just do that.
One of the things that Warhol understood that a lot of great business people understand is you can't lead in America. You can't get up in front with a flag and make people go anywhere. What you do is you move to the edge, declare that the center, and let everybody reorganize the world around you. And in a sense, that's what Warhol did. He created a center that was on the edge, but basically the world would reorganize its way around it.
At the end of January 1964, Warhol found a new studio.
All right, I want to stop that for a second because that was huge, what he just said there. What he said there was absolutely huge. So if you want to change the world, you pick a place to be on the edge of the world that already exists, and then you let the world reorganize itself around you. So you don't change the world. You just pick a place to be and then park yourself there and let the world come to you. Absolutely huge thing. Huge thing. And something I'm going to put into practice at some point along the way when I've found the place I want to plant me flag or whatever. I don't really use flag metaphors, but it works for this context, really.
He needed a different space. There's a simple entry in his day books where he kept a record of all his expenses. New studio, I think the date is January 24th or January 26th, and the address, 231 East 47th Street. This is the studio that became or would become the factory.
The factory, how to explain the impact of what it felt like is really rare. Something that it probably hasn't happened in this century in the art scene. It was just the ultra salon, but in the days of acid trips, you know, it was high powered lightning bolts, Velvet Underground, Andy Warhol, superstars, all in like a 3-year period. It was a peak. Anyone who came to New York from Europe, the Stones had it. You gotta go to the factory, you know, or from California, Jim Morrison comes, you gotta go to the factory. You know, someone would bring you to the factory if you were famous in any way. It was just the burner was always on.
The factory was a very porous social space. It's where Warhol worked, it's where he made his paintings, where he made his films, and it's also where he received people. It becomes becomes the center then of his public life. And his public life includes his work life. And that's, I think, one of the great changes that's taking place right now is how Warhol totally gets the idea of sociability and art, but they're not exclusive operations, and how the social and the personal and the interpersonal permeate his art, as indeed I think they always have, because I think his art was always about feelings, how people feel, how people respond, and how they respond to one another. The films certainly bring this into the foreground, bring this into high relief. And at the very beginning, he invites a young man named Billy Linick, who became known as Billy Name, to decorate the space, make it silver.
Somebody brought Andy over to this haircutting salon type thing that I was doing. And he was so taken by my apartment, he said, "Oh, Billy, I just got this big new loft space uptown. Would you do this to my new loft, you know, the silver thing?"
It was a perfect time to think silver. Silver was the future. It was spacey. The astronauts wore silver suits, and their equipment was silver, too. And silver was also the past, the silver screen. Hollywood actresses photographed on silver sets. And maybe more than anything else, silver was narcissism. Mirrors were backed with silver. Andy Warhol.
In January 1964, armed with an industrial staple gun, rolls of aluminum foil, and dozens of cans of silver spray paint, Billy Linick got to work, devoting most of the next 4 months to transforming the dark and dingy industrial space, using his skills as a lighting technician to rewire the lighting system. Within a few weeks, the shy and quietly reliable Linick had taken up unofficial residence in the new space. For the next 5 years, he would serve as the factory's unofficial manager, custodian, and gatekeeper, sleeping at night in a makeshift nest in one of the two small bathrooms in back, while each day hosting a steady stream of flamboyant downtown friends, most of whom shared his love of grand opera, wildly excessive gesture, and methamphetamine, or speed.
I am always accused of bringing the criminal underground drug culture into the factory scene. And it's true, I did. Because Andy was sort of shy and careful about who he knew, but because I was competent, he trusted me implicitly to be able to control whatever situation I allowed to happen. And so I brought this element up to the factory with me. And Undine was probably the prime exponent of it because he was flamboyant and outgoing, and I was very shy and behind-the-scenes type guy. But all of those extremes were these people that I knew from the village who were the mole people or the amphetamine people, and they were all brilliant.
Prominent among the factory hangers-on were a charismatic, non-stop verbal pyrotechnician named Robert Olivo, who called himself Undine, after the female lead in an experimental French play. A talented, desperately self-destructive dancer named Freddie Herko. And Bridget Berlin, the often abusively hot-tempered daughter of the chairman of the Hearst publishing empire. Over the next 5 years, thanks to Warhol's steadily increasing fame, the factory would gather in a cast of extreme characters from downtown, including a roster of drug addicts and drag queens, like Candy Darling, Rotten Rita, and Hollywood Long, a transvestite hustler who liked to describe herself as a disgrace to the world's oldest profession.
The thing that I thought was most interesting about it is that the dominant people in the scene were all of these working class drag queens. You know, you got Andini, you got Candy and these people. And yeah, they're drag queens, but they're also like working class dudes from Queens and Brooklyn, you know. The interesting thing, I think, you know, if you look at that crowd in the factory, there are very few products of American middle class culture. You got the top, you got the bottom. You got the drag queens, you got the flower children from, you know, Harvard and Stanford. And so the tonality of it was like really strange.
I don't really feel all these people are hanging around me, Warhol once remarked. I'm more hanging around them.
He had a great eye for talent. One of his many talents was spotting people. He would spot people that were interesting and powerful. And once he made a decision about them, you were in. That made these people who had spent most of their lives being rejected and treated as scum feel pretty good. They couldn't wait to gather around. It was the great good place. It was the other world where you could go and everything would be good. You could be a freak. You could be out of it. So he created this place where the misbegotten of the world could all gather and feel great. I think in a sense, the factory was a microcosm of what went on in the 60s, the confusion, the anti-establishment marches, protests, the insistence of the individual, the sense of getting away from the normal. All of that was part of what Andy stood for. Excess, drugs, speed, except not by him, but by everybody around him.
Always hypersensitive to the effect of any drug, Warhol himself rarely took anything stronger than a diet pill called Opatrol. And even then, never more than a quarter of a pill a day. Though that was enough, he recalled, to give you that wired, happy, go, go, go feeling in your stomach. It made you want to work, work, work.
I think that was really the period in his life where he just decided to redo himself utterly, and he became a whole different person. There were a lot of people in his life who he knew before that didn't fit into that world very well. I certainly didn't, and didn't want to. He was so different that it was as though he couldn't be his old self anymore. Carl Willers.
I'd like to try to talk some.
Little by little, as he moved further and further into the spotlight of his own increasing celebrity, the boyish, faintly elfin and open vulnerability of his younger days began to give way to an increasingly inscrutable public persona, modeled in part on the hip and sometimes sullen outward demeanor of Billy Linux mall people. Once voluble enough, he rarely laughed or spoke in public now, and when he did, adopted a strange, emotionless voice that some compared to Jackie Kennedy's public speaking style.
I can't, I'm so empty today, I can't think of anything. Why don't you just tell me the words, and they'll just come out of my mouth.
No, don't worry about it, because no, I think it'd be so nice.
At the same time, his studied insistence on his own shallowness now reached a new extreme. If you want to know all about Andy Warhol, he insisted, just look at the surface of my paintings and my films, and there I am. There's nothing behind it.
See, he was two different people. If you want to get really simplistic, there was the public persona, and then there was a private persona. He always said he couldn't draw, okay? But he actually had, he was a great draftsman at the same time. You know, he said he couldn't read, or didn't like to read, he read all the time. He was a good conversationalist, but then in public, the screen went down, and his persona that he created, this artwork of himself, comes forward.
And then I made things like,
an effacement of personality, which was at the same time an assertion of personality. And he got that right away, because he was a very smart guy. If I pretend to have no personality at all, I'll be Andy Warhol. And that's more powerful. What you mustn't do is try to have a personality, put on an act, because I don't know how to put on an act. So put on no act. Just let it all fade away. And that worked for him. And it was a very interesting insight into the nature of a personality in a world of personalities and celebrities.
This is definitely the clip I'm using, like, there's no doubt about that. At least 20 minutes of it with 3 minutes cut out because it had music on it that I won't be able to use. But that was definitely the clip. All right, guys, I've been running for an hour now, so I'm probably going to close the room down and get on with having something to eat. because I got distracted by the show and I haven't had anything to eat yet. So thanks for coming in. I do appreciate it. And I'll post this one on Podbean a bit late, on Telegram a bit later on the Free Association page on Telegram. I'll post this afternoon's radio show is what I'm going to post on Podbean, because I want to make sure there's no music in there. All right, people are still coming in. That's interesting. So this is a good time. I think this is a good time for people. So I'll keep doing Saturday warm-up shows as well, because that seems to work. And I'll do them about the same time, about 10 o'clock or just after 10 o'clock, my time. Because it does get my voice warmed up properly, and it gets me in the right frame of mind to do a show this afternoon. All right, so thanks for coming in, guys. I'm going to wrap this up. Oh, I'm Dennis Barker on Telegram. I'm in the South Osman group. Well, so Dennis Barker, Dennis with two N's, and then Barker on Telegram. I'm Radio Projects or Open Philosopher everywhere else, pretty much. Open Philosopher on Discord and on the radio station this afternoon. All right, Sean, I'll pop in into your show for a little bit, but I need to get something to eat as well, so I'll just be listening. Thanks for coming in, guys. Appreciate it.